Just hours before she is supposed to arrive in court for a paternity hearing, new mother Etta Real disappears. Her sisters say she told them she had patched up things with the man she was claiming to be her newborn's father, and that the two were heading to New York to get married. The man claimed the two were never intimate, and that he planned to expose her lies. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane. At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
This week, we are joined by Marcia Mason.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, you're pretty busy this week, right?
I am. And it looks like you've been pretty busy writing this week.
I have. But first, I launched Girl Hunt, which is a true crime newsletter, which really focuses on women and women's stories. So it's a little bit, it jumps off kind of some of what we talk about here, but it's its own thing.
Yeah. So for people who haven't visited Amy's new newsletter, if you like the content we're putting out here, that's like a really good compliment to it. Because I've noticed that you put some things that are sometimes overlapping or things that are completely new.
Yes.
So it's a great place to get a little bit more content about missing and unidentified women, but like in a different way.
Right. So like, for instance, I was curious how many of the women we've covered have been turned into ghost stories. So I did a piece on that. There's also a piece about like kind of some other crime elements. So yeah, it just kind of bridges off, and it's just a really different opportunity for me to do some extra writing and on topics that I care about. And I know that other people do as well. So it's been doing really well. And I hope people go to girlhuntmedia.com and you can sign up for a weekly newsletter. But Vanessa, enough chit chat. Well, some slight chit chat. So like, I don't know if you've noticed, but I have been in a 1930s, 1940s kind of mood lately. Like a lot of the stories we've been telling here, like happened in that era.
Mm-hmm. Are we still doing?
Yeah.
We're in the 1930s still?
We are in the 1930s. And I confess, like, I think like sometimes when we tell stories that happened from that time, like, they feel like they happened so long ago. Almost like they're like myths or tales. But like every time I sit down and talk to you about them, like, and we talk about the women and the lives they lived, like, I just feel like we often have like all these like connections with them, like similarities of like their lives, our current lives, that like doesn't happen unless you talk about them, right?
It's so weird because it feels so distant and different, but also so familiar.
Like, right.
Like so much like it could actually be happening now too. I personally, you know that I have an easier time sometimes discussing these because of the distance. Like anything like once we're in the 2000s, it's like it's very difficult to talk about.
Right. Yeah.
And like even in the 90s a little bit, because like, you know, being like a teen in the 90s, I was like the same age as a lot of the women we talk about.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do appreciate these older stories just for how it feels like. It feels like we're actually remembering, like bringing something into remembrance that is so far gone. Like these names don't get spoken on a daily basis, and it feels really good to talk about them.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking, because I was like, why am I, like, because like I've just been like revisiting kind of this era, like these stories. I think it's like as well, like, recently, this year, I had been listening to this press conference, and I know I've mentioned it before, but I think it had a dramatic impact on me, which is basically there was this search for this woman named Mary Jane Croft Van Gilder, and she had gone missing in 1945, right? And this detective, his name is Adam Turner, he spent all this time trying to find Mary Jane, like looking for her and looking for her. And he was told by other law enforcement agencies, like, hey, the case is too old. We're not going to pursue any of these unidentified people that we have. No one cares about this. And like, she doesn't really matter. Like, there's no one alive today that like this matters to. And I was like, because like the truth is like, you know, on just a very basic level, like Mary Jane mattered. But on a secondary level, like the reason this man was looking is because her kids, Mary Jane's kids, had been looking. And yes, they passed away, but also their kids had been looking. So there's like this generational trauma.
Right.
Associated with it. So to say that nobody cares, like there aren't.
There are still people who care. They just might not have known her directly.
Yes. And so, yeah. So I think like about that. And I think that was like a turning point. So I just want to say like as many of these women's names as possible. Because that pain and that absence of someone being missing that like just doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. And so that's definitely true for the story that I'm sharing today. And before we get into it, just a note of caution, we are going to be discussing suicide and suicidal ideation in this episode. I'm going to start this story in a bit of a different way, which is to read an excerpt from a newspaper article written by a man named Howard Handelman in December 1935. He's a man who understood the lifelong legacy of a missing loved one in a family's life. To preface all of this, he is writing about a toddler named Alma Hart Riel, who was, at the time of his article, 15 months old. Now, Alma's mother, Etta Riel, had gone missing the previous year in November 1934, and Etta lived in Massachusetts. So this is truly a beautiful and poignant piece that he writes. It begins, "The happy, healthy, 15 months old baby does not know the fate of her pretty unwed mother, and had been a mystery to police of a dozen states for more than a year. As she plays peekaboo, the little rag doll clutched lovingly in her arms, she does not know the identity of her father may forever remain an unsolved mystery. As she takes her first faltering baby steps, she does not know that someday she may walk for hours in the Oxford swampland, wondering if the body of her young mother is lying at the bottom of a bog. Today she laughs and makes faces at a mirror, not realizing that someday she may study her features in an effort to find a resemblance to a man who may be her father. Baby Alma is learning to talk and to understand her aunts and uncles who shower her with attention, not knowing that someday the tragedy of her life may make her wish she were unable to communicate with others. But life for Alma is happy now. Her toy box is filled with playthings, all of which take a back seat to the battered rag doll. Although her vocabulary is limited to Dada and Mama, she talks incessantly. She gnaws at her playthings with her two little teeth, which have broken through her gums. The neighborhood children come to play with Alma, keeping her days busy. Now she is enveloped in the protecting shield of babyhood, oblivious to the tragic strife which had been part of her life."
My goodness. So who wrote this? Just to recap that again, Howard Handelman?
Yeah, so he was a reporter in the 1930s and covered the year, a little over a year after.
Gosh, he wrote beautifully.
Yeah.
Especially just like thinking these things. This is a very thoughtful piece.
Yes, and it really speaks to what happens when someone goes missing and how does that impact someone for years after. Yeah. So I was surprised to see it in the 1930s.
Especially paper. Since so many people always are like, oh, it's lucky she's a baby. She won't remember.
Yeah. And he was thinking through like what happens to her long term.
Yeah.
We're going to find out more of what happens to Alma long term. But, you know, the author of this, he's right in many ways, but in many others, he doesn't know what comes next for Alma. Like, for many years of her life, she actually won't be searching for her mother in the swamplands or communicate her loss. That's because for many years, Alma believed that her aunt and uncle were her parents. Mm,
that's got to be a shock when she learned that.
Yeah, so she learns this as a teenager.
Wow.
And she learns that her mother was named Etta and that she was missing. And at this time, her aunt and uncle also said that they believed they knew who her father was. For the purposes of this story, we're going to call him H. Alma's family told her then, when she was a teenager, that H was likely her father and that he was dead. She had no reason to believe that this wasn't the truth at the time.
So we know by the initial, but H.
Right.
So is involved, right?
So I'm not insinuating anything here, but H was not the best guy.
Okay. So. And is he in fact dead, or are you going to talk about that later?
We're going to talk about that later. Yeah.
I'm always getting ahead, aren't I?
You are.
Too many questions.
Don't jump ahead.
Okay. I'll stop asking those kind of questions.
So first we have to find out a little bit more about Alma and what happened to Etta. So what Alma likely learns about her mother in those early years of finding out who her mother was and what happened is that her mother's case is quite known in the state of Massachusetts and that her mother's story is remembered by them. Now, what she also likely learns is that people all over the country have also heard her mother's story in the form of Wood Pulp True Crime Magazine stories. I love that it's like Wood Pulp because there was a cheap magazine. Mm-hmm. As well as through a WOR radio show reenactment of her mother's case. So this was broadcast across the country. In short, we don't actually hear much about Etta now, but her and her case were quite famous.
So it's funny because, like, I am not the true crime specialist in this duo. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not a true crime person. But my grandmother used to love reading those kinds of magazines. Mm-hmm. So she was definitely, like, if she was here today, she would be, I think, our top fans.
Well, like, I could appreciate that. And I could go off on, like, a whole rant and education session about the history of true crime and how it's not a modern invention.
No.
Yeah.
That was her way of unwinding at the end of the day was like her treat her, my mom always referred to them as her murder magazines. So, yeah. So they're, you know, relaxing in the 1940s and 50s with her murder magazines.
Right. And now it's like listening to podcasts or watching TV documentaries or TV shows. Yeah. So Etta was born in 1914 to a relatively large family of 9 children, headed by her father, Joseph Napoleon Real, and Roseanne Tatro, which I have to pause here because we just did an episode about Gloria Kidder Corzon, and I remarked how strange it was that she had family from the small upstate New York town that my husband was from. Mm-hmm. And, well, so does Etta. Yes.
Same place.
Her father and her paternal grandparents are also from this small, very upstate New York town.
But it's small.
Super small.
Emphasis on the small.
Yes.
Okay.
And I was like, what?
That's so funny. Yeah.
Okay. That has nothing to do with anything. But every time I come across that, I'm like, what? Yeah. So I feel like anytime we do a Massachusetts case now or something with Massachusetts connections, I need to like check that. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know. I don't know what the
link between Massachusetts and there is.
Yeah. What's the...
I don't know.
Now, Etta's father worked for the Osgood Bradley Car Company as a machinist building out railway passenger cars, but he passed away when she was just 13. It looks like, for the most part, Etta's older brothers were working to support the family. When Etta was at Oxford High School, she met H, and the two were described as being sweethearts around this time. When they graduated, though, H was headed to Bates College in Maine, and for the most part, H was really active on campus and seemed to be enjoying his time there. He was in athletics, specifically football and track and field, where he threw the javelin. And he also had the lead role in the varsity play called Alice Sit by the Fire. He said that H was a good student and was highly regarded on campus, but despite this, H leaves suddenly and doesn't return for the 1934-1935 academic year.
So you said he's not a good guy because he sounds like he started life as a pretty cool guy.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, all the trappings of like the good college student, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to learn some things about him. It's like, meanwhile, Etta is back home in Massachusetts and she is also trying to further her education by going to a teaching college. There was one major complication for Etta in achieving this goal. She was pregnant. Mm. And as far as I can tell, she always maintained that this was H's child. Now, doing some calculations here, since her daughter, Alma, was born in September 1934, Etta became pregnant around December of 1933 or January of 1934, which I will point out does fall within the usual holiday semester break of colleges, but I digress because I just want you to tuck that away.
We're remembering that.
Yes.
We're remembering a holiday break.
Well,
and you know, getting pregnant.
And getting pregnant. Yes.
Okay.
Now, I think in our modern understanding of how pregnancy outside of marriage was handled historically, like, is that we tend to believe that women who became pregnant would have, like, you know, kept these pregnancies secret, or this would have been a shameful thing, right? Mm-hmm. But our perspectives are really shaped by narratives of what norms would have been like for certain demographics. And as a working class family, it really didn't seem to be the case with Etta. Like, she maintained her connections with friends through her pregnancy, and she still lived with her family. There was no, like,
nobody's kicking her out or sending her somewhere so she can have the baby and then they can put it up for adoption.
Exactly. And bring it back and... No. Okay. So, yeah. So her family was aware. Like, everyone knows.
Okay.
She's pregnant. But despite this kind of support, it does seem that Etta was struggling with depression and suicidal ideation, meaning she was considering death through suicide. So if you picture kind of what's happening here, she's pregnant, which means it's unlikely she's still in those classes, and that would be putting her career aspirations in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. The man who she says got her pregnant is away at college. And while the two are sending letter after letter to one another, ones that detail all the external forces that are keeping them apart, like family, finances, and religion, H doesn't seem ready to commit to her. And while I can't find any engagement announcement to back this up, people say he becomes engaged to someone else during this time.
Ew.
Yeah. He gets the initial for many reasons.
Hmm.
And so Etta writes to her friends that spring, and again later in the fall, that she's been considering suicide as a result of her affair, but that ultimately decided not to do it in favor of going away to protect the man she loves. We know she doesn't, but, like, that's what she's saying to them. She also writes to one friend stating that we have patched up our difficulties, particularly our religious ones.
Did she write that?
Yeah, so that's what Etta writes, that they've patched up their difficulties.
And that she's going to go
Protect him, yeah. So she, at some point, she communicates that to a friend.
Go away to protect him. Yes. So she's not going towards him. She's just going
away
elsewhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, though she doesn't name H specifically, many assume this is who she meant when she's talking about we have patched up things or protecting him, right? Okay. And at times, she does seem really bereft in her letters, and at others, quite hopeful about their future. But, like, she kind of just swung between these two emotions regularly. Now, Etta gives birth to her daughter Alma on September 22nd. Because she's unmarried, no father was listed on Alma's birth certificate, something that I'm assuming was likely devastating to Etta. On October 8th, Etta wrote to a friend, "I wanted to kill myself last Sunday night. I promised myself to go on living for him as I have always done. I loved him and promised him all the happiness it was in my power to give."
So again, we're staying alive for him,
mm-hmm.
the dude, possibly H,
mm-hmm.
not for the child, though.
Yeah, so, you know, she's really wrapped up in this, like, love affair.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, like, she's not specific about who the he is. Like, we're just going to make this assumption that it's H, because actually after her daughter's birth, she does take her paternity charges to the next level. No longer does she want it just assumed that H is the father. She wants it known.
Okay.
So she actually presses charges against him, charging paternity, and he's arrested. He does get out on $800 bail. Yeah.
I'm confused.
So, yeah. So, basically,
please
at this time...
Please explain. Why is he getting arrested? I get that he's not a great guy, but why would he get arrested over this?
Right. So, it's, like, different laws in terms of, like, pregnancy outside of marriage, that kind of thing. So, she gets him arrested basically to force a paternity suit.
Right? Okay.
So, she basically wants him listed on the birth certificate, but for that to happen, it has to go to court. So, the processes are a little bit different.
Without, like...
Yeah, okay, so...
DNA or anything.
Well, okay. So, the trial is set for November 22nd. That's where he's going to publicly face her accusations that he's the father of her child.
Okay.
And because I was wondering this, too, like, in the 1930s and 1940s, there was, like, kind of this new understanding that you could actually prove paternity in terms of, like... heredity, right?
Okay.
So primarily at this time, this would have been done through blood typing.
Okay. Okay. Right. So they weren't like comparing like this eye color, no. or this nose shape.
Yeah, we weren't there.
On this little squishy baby.
No. So okay. they're doing, you know, blood typing. Okay. So it's not sophisticated.
It's not great, but it's not way off. But also it could be way off because right. who's to say your two boyfriends don't have the same blood type?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So this is what she's pursuing.
Not saying that she has two boyfriends because I don't think she does, right? She just has.
She might.
She might?
I don't know. Etta? We love Etta. Okay.
Okay.
Now, okay. At the time, though, H is publicly maintaining that he has never had sex with Etta.
Because he, yeah.
Yeah.
Is he just, do we think he's just lying? Or did maybe he not?
Well, so at this time, I don't know, right? So he's allowed to kind of go around and say, like, I didn't have sex with her. Therefore, I can't be the father of her child, right?
Right. Because, like, how would you prove?
Mm-hmm.
Either way.
Right.
Huh.
Yeah. And so she's really trying to do this heavy lift here in proving that he's the father of her child.
Can you imagine how many guys were like that?
Yeah.
Not having to take responsibility, especially married ones. Like, no. We right. never had sex.
Yeah. And, you know, so I don't know when the engagement happens, but I do know he is engaged to someone else. And so if he's engaged at the time, like, he has got this extra measure of, like, not wanting that to come out.
Right. Well, like, there's his parents. There's any, like,
yeah.
people at school or, like, future employers. And then the girlfriend.
Right.
The actual girlfriend.
Yeah.
So. And
I want to be clear here because I've seen photos of both H and Etta, and like Etta was doing some charity work here.
Was he dating up? Way up?
I think so. She's a cutie and I've got some concerns. But yeah. Now, on November 20th, so to back up because we want to remember this date, the trial is set for November 22nd to prove paternity. So okay. he's got to go to court. Because this is what's happening. Now, November 20th, Helen Kennedy, who is one of Etta's friends, went shopping with her. And they went into, oh my God.
Worcester.
Massachusetts residence with your town names. Worcester. Oh God.
Yeah. It's like just, it's the Worcester.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Now, they're going shopping.
Or is it Worcester?
I don't even know.
No, I just confused myself. Maybe it's Worcester.
You know, because I listened to, like, the audio of Worcester? A man who was telling me how to pronounce it correctly, but he also has a Massachusetts accent. And so I can't say it like he said it. So Worcester, I'm sorry. Worcester,
whatever.
Massachusetts.
I guess anyway. You guys know, right? We'll just move on. Let's not say it ever
We're
again.
We're so ashamed. Okay. Now, it's okay. So they go into town. That town.
Okay.
And they're shopping for some clothes that Etta can wear to court for Etta's case against H. Helen said that at the time, Etta seemed in excellent spirits, and Helen's described as one of Etta's closest confidants, so she would know.
Okay.
And she says that Etta had confided in her all of her secrets, but that she didn't think that Etta was considering suicide at the time. So
it's been in the letters, but not, like, voiced.
Well, not voiced in this time, at this time when they're shopping on November 20th.
Like, okay, so just like...
She's not talking
right
to her
Right now,
about,
we are not thinking about it.
No, we're not talking about it with Helen. We're shopping. We're getting ready for court case, right?
Okay.
Now, so she's focused on this court case. On November 21st, Etta was over at her friend Teresa Pariseau's house getting her hair set. Like, I get the sense that this is in preparation for the court hearing, which would have been the next day. It was 10 o'clock p.m. when H arrived at this house. Now, the Pariseaus, they say that H was really pushing for what they described as a renewed friendship between the two, between him and Etta, and that Etta wasn't interested at all. Eventually, though, H does offer to drive Etta home, and initially Etta also rejects this as well. But perhaps because it's really late at this time, or... She's maybe feeling amenable to what he's saying. She does say she'll go with him, but only if Teresa will accompany them.
Okay. We're not making it to the court case, are we?
No.
No.
Now, they head out of the house together. So it's Teresa, Etta, and H. But for some reason, Teresa gets left behind.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Okay. Now, we only have H's word for what happens next, but he says that the two of them talked in the car for quite a while and that he made clear that if she continued to press for paternity, he would reveal that she had been sexually involved with other men.
And is there any truth to that?
Well, we don't know.
Okay.
Right? But he's...
He's just gonna say that regardless.
He's gonna say that regardless, right? Okay. Now, if that conversation went the way he claimed, it doesn't explain what happens next. At around 1 a.m., they arrive at the apartment house that Etta shares with her family. Etta heads inside and H stays in the car. Now, inside the apartment, Etta starts scribbling a note to her sisters on the back of an envelope. Her note says, "I'll be back this weekend after Snoony," which is her nickname for her daughter. "Please don't worry." I feel like you want to say something about Snoony.
Well, first off, Snoony is adorable. I don't know where that came from, but it's really cute. But she's... Are we skipping over the whole court case thing?
Well, okay.
Like, so she's leaving and then she'll only come back on the weekend?
Right. So she says...
Are they heading somewhere else for the court case? Is that why?
No. She says she is, like, leaving with H.
Are they... So they're skipping the court case at this point?
Sounds like that's what she's saying.
Okay. No. And she'll be back after the weekend for Snoony.
For Snoony. Yeah. What a cute name.
So cute.
We'll be back in a moment. Now, her sisters wake up as she's packing a small zippered bag with some clothing, and her sister, Alice, said that Etta was excited when they spoke, and she further explained that she was going to New York to get married to H, who, by the way, she calls him Red as a nickname. Mm. According to Alice, Etta's words were, "Red and I have made up. We're going to be married."
So did he threaten to, like... tell about her past, or did he ask her to marry him? Like, what is happening here?
Yeah, okay, so you have him telling his side of the story, which is that the two of them were not in agreement, and that he had not had sex with her, he was not the father, and that he was going to tell the world who she was having sex with.
Right.
On the other hand, you have other witnesses.
Right, some saying he wanted to be friends.
Yes. So you've got the parasos who are like, oh, he's trying to patch up things.
Yeah.
And then you also have her sisters who said, no, our sister came in and said, hey, we've made up. We're going to go get married.
Right. So there's like these.
Yeah. So it's like a
he said, she said, definitely.
Yeah. Now, Alice said that Etta didn't have any money on her, so she grabbed $2 from the house funds and then rushed back out to H's car. That's the last time Alice saw her sister. Now, H says their intention, again, is not to be married and that he simply drove her to the Union Station in Worcester because she planned to take a train to New York. He says that he left her there. And that's the last he saw of her.
Okay. So that was the last Alice sees of her sister. And now he's saying he drove her to this station. And then that's the last he sees of her.
Yes. Now, 10 days later, Frank Jablonski, he's Etta's lawyer in the paternity case. He receives a telegram from New York City from Etta stating that she would like to drop the case against H.
So between then and now, it's been 10 days and nobody's seen Etta.
Right.
But we have this message.
We have this message.
This telegram.
Okay. So we know that Etta was last seen in the early morning hours of November 22nd, 1934. But it takes until February of 1935 for her case to reach the papers. It's unclear why this happened, but my best guess is that her family had been kind of waiting for her to return to Massachusetts after her wedding. Like, I don't know what they thought, but...
Wait, what?
Because that's what they thought that she went to go do.
So this whole time, we think she's gone away to get married, and she hasn't called, written...
Come back for
Snoony. Her daughter. No. Snoony.
Yeah.
And that we also haven't heard from H either.
I don't think so, no.
Mm.
So it doesn't reach the paper for months.
4 months.
Yeah. So police start digging into this case as quickly as possible. Again, they're months behind, though. And they make public her relationship with H. But they do initially state he is not a suspect. In searching through Etta's things, they do find what are described as love letters between Etta and H. The ones in her possession are obviously the ones written by H. And when he's asked about these, though, he states it's not possible, that he didn't write those letters to Etta, and they must be forgeries.
So they did find him at this point?
Yes.
So they find him, but not her. And then now all of a sudden he's like, yeah, no, those aren't mine. Mm-hmm. Because he doesn't want to be connected to whatever happened to her?
Yes.
Is that what we're going with?
I think.
Because, like...
But he doesn't want any connection with her at all. So he goes to, like... No, we dated to... But we didn't have sex to... Oh, I didn't even write those letters to her. They must be fake. Yeah.
That's... It's confusing, like, what's going on in his head.
Yeah, so there's some distancing behavior there, right? Mm-hmm. Now, police also do soon hear of the telegram her lawyer received, and they start investigating that angle. Because if Etta is in New York, they need to know. Their first order of business is tracing where the telegram was sent from. They soon learn it was, indeed, sent from New York City, but from a cigar store on the corner of Lenox Avenue and 94th Street. The telegram says it's from Etta, but it also gives an address where she's staying. In investigating this address, they go to 125th Street, where it says she's living, and instead they find an empty lot, only occupied by a pile of bricks. Now, do you have some thoughts on that? You're making a face.
H is doing things. And that's what you think. Etta. That's what I'm going to think.
Okay. Now, while in New York, Deputy Sheriff Arthur Keefe, he says he pays a visit to Mrs. Gertrude Holden in Flushing. She taught both H and Etta in her classes at Oxford High School. He asks her to do a handwriting analysis between the letters that she had in her house and the love letters that she found at Etta's. And you're like, ooh, where is that going to leave?
Yes.
But my favorite part of the reporting on this is they don't actually make clear what conclusions were drawn from this analysis.
Oh, I was expecting, like...
Yeah.
Something fun.
No. They made, like, such a big deal about, like, doing this handwriting analysis, but they don't actually say, like, what...
So Miss Gertrude Holden in Flushing couldn't figure...
No. Well, okay. Maybe she did, and they just never specifically said she did.
Huh.
But what they do walk away with, though, is the certainty that something is indeed wrong and that something could have happened to Etta.
Well, obviously, I mean, if we have a groom but no bride, like, something wrong with... Like, something wrong's happening.
Well, again, so that's what her sisters are saying is like, hey, this is the conversation that happened. Like, she said she was going to go get married. But H is still saying, like, that was not what was happening. That is not true. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the earliest investigative theories that takes hold is that Etta may have been murdered the night of her disappearance and buried in North Cemetery. The theory is that the night of her disappearance, there may have been an open grave awaiting a burial the next day, and that her murderer concealed her there by digging the grave a bit deeper and buried her. The next day, unsuspecting mourners would have placed their loved one in the grave on top of her without ever suspecting
she was there. No. Really? That's incredibly creepy, and that's, like, very, like, diabolical plan.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
I mean, okay, so to me this seems like a joke meme. Like, how to get away with murder.
Yeah, right? Like, this is, like, what you'd expect, like, a cartoonist or something, right?
To, yeah.
Like, put as, like, a funny thing.
Right. So I was like, where is this even coming from? Because, like, right. I can't figure out, like, why is this one of the earliest conclusions that they've drawn? And I really didn't know until I learned that H's stepfather was actually a grave digger working in North Cemetery.
Okay. So
I think this is their way of saying we're suspicious.
We're pointing the finger really directly at H by saying this.
But without naming.
Without naming him.
Yes.
But we're also coming up with a really intricate plan on what happened.
Right.
is there ever any evidence to back this up?
Well, okay, they do find one possible grave that coincides in terms of the dates, and that's for a man named Louis Drzebicki, who died of heart disease at the age of 32. Now, the papers describe him as an obscure citizen. Those are the words they use. But you can see actually from his grave marker today that he had plenty of family in the area. He's not an obscure citizen. Now, the only way to prove or disprove this theory is to dig up Louis. And sentiment on this is really divided. It sounds like some of the investigating police are all for it. They're ready to go. But District Attorney Hoban, he keeps putting the brakes on this. He's like, we are not doing this.
And I mean, honestly, they wouldn't be digging him up. They'd be bringing just his casket up and checking below and then putting him back.
Right. Which
I'd be on the team for that.
For it.
Because I bet he would be, like, if there was somebody buried under me, I want them to do what they need to do to see.
Well, you would be dead, so yeah. You wouldn't know.
But I'm telling you right now, that if that happens, and there's rumors that somebody's been murdered in place below me, do you have my full permission to check?
You are on record
saying that. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know. I will be, like, cremains, or I will at a science institute, so I don't know.
But, like, if they have to slide you over...
Right.
To find the murdered remains, do you give
permission? They are welcome. Yes.
There you go.
Now, one of the reasons that the District Attorney Hoban is successful in kind of putting off this idea, though, is that people keep reporting seeing Etta.
Hmm.
Yeah. Now, one of the principal sightings is from a man named Hugh Stacy, who claims he just saw Etta that February. Now, Vanessa, you and I've been talking about missing women long enough to know that a lot of these sightings, particularly like once the stories are all over the media, they're pretty common, and most often they don't check out. Right.
So that was going to be my next question, is does Hugh Stacy know her personally?
Yes.
Oh, he does.
Yes.
So he's not just some guy that's being like, yeah, this girl looks just like her.
No. So he actually, there's a lot of validity here, a lot of weight given to it, because his brother is married to one of Etta's older sisters.
Okay.
So obviously he would recognize her.
He would. Did he talk to her?
No. So he says he is in Copley Square in Boston on February 7th when he is waiting on the street and he sees a passing streetcar with Etta inside. And he said he raced after the streetcar to board it, hoping to catch up with Etta, but was unsuccessful.
Okay.
Now, there are several problems with Hugh's statement, though. One, he actually hasn't seen Etta since the summer of 1932, when they both briefly lived on his brother's and her sister's farm. And, like, I can be kind of forgiving of that, because they did spend time together. They are family, right? Because, and also, how much can Etta have changed between those two times? But the other issue is that on Friday, so he sees her on Thursday, on Friday, soon after, he steals a car from Marblehead.
Hmm.
And he ends up crashing it on Saturday evening in Manchester. So he's actually making all these statements about seeing Etta from inside the Marblehead police station.
So he's in a police station.
So he says that he sees her on Thursday.
Yes.
Friday, he steals a car. Saturday, he wrecks the car. Sunday, he's arrested.
So does he say that... Is he only relaying the information after he's arrested?
Yes.
So he didn't say that on Thursday when he saw her.
He didn't go to anyone.
A few days old information that he's saying maybe to distract from what he's just done.
Yeah, I think so. He's not necessarily the most trustworthy source. Like,
where are the trustworthy guys?
Nowhere. Now, this is all enough, though, for Hoban, the DA, to put a halt to the whole grave digging her, right?
No, we have to look under there still.
Right, so, but they do investigate. They follow up with his statements, Hugh's statements, and they say, like, no, they debunk them. Like, in the meantime, though, more people start popping up saying that Etta, they've seen her over the past few days and weeks, including people who know her well.
Hmm.
So again, this seems promising, but interestingly, they all describe her wearing the exact same thing she was last seen wearing when she disappeared, which is another thing we've seen it's a lot of.
Interesting, right? But not so interesting because it's what people do.
Yeah. Now, the same outfit that's described in the
press. Right, not a new outfit.
No. So it really seems unlikely that this would be true given the amount of time that passed between when she went missing and when she was being reported, you know, them seeing her. But by mid-February, they also seemed to move away from the grave theory, stating that the grave wasn't dug until November 22nd. And if she went missing in the early morning hours of that day, it was unlikely she would have ended up in there. So, like, the grave wasn't dug until after she was last seen. Now, by February 14th, D.A. Hoban is making public his desire to find Etta. He states, "I wanted enough men to check every single clue in this case and do it quickly. I'm not going to be satisfied until we have ascertained whether Etta Real is alive or dead. If she is still alive, we want to know where she is. If she's dead, we want to know by what manner she came to her death." But the case is really not going anywhere. On February 16th, they bring H back in for questioning, going over what happened for 7 hours. And he sticks to his story that the two talked in his car for an hour before they parted ways at the train station. Finally, on March 1st, another clue comes in. This is that on the night of her disappearance, workers at Union Station reported receiving 3 phone calls. The first is from an unknown man who asks a station attendant to look for a girl by the name of Riel at the station. The second comes in a few minutes later, and it's a woman's voice asking if they find the Riel girl to hold her there. And the third call is a few minutes later, also a woman's voice asking if they found the Riel girl, and when the attendant said no, the woman hung up.
So this is from the workers at the train station?
Yes.
That's really weird.
Right. Now, obviously, these are very suspicious calls. Mm-hmm. What can we make of them? You know, obviously, whoever's calling would have had to know that Etta planned on being there that night. And to my knowledge, the callers, they've never been identified, but neither have they been fully proven to have happened. So That's kind of floating in the air.
That just seems weird.
Yeah. Now, either way, those calls don't bring investigators any closer to finding Etta. At the end of March, as the weather began improving, some hunters and woodsmen start searching the woods in the area. Because there's no evidence that she's alive, they're convinced that Etta is dead and that her body is somewhere in the area. This starts out as a small group of about 12 to 20 men, and it soon grows in momentum, and law enforcement joins them in early April, and then the Civilian Conservation Corps sends workers from the East Douglas Camp, and the Boy Scouts come on board as well. At one point, they estimate as many as 1,000 searchers are scouring the area looking for Etta. Now, this isn't easy terrain to search. This includes at least 15 ponds, one of which they've described as bottomless. Spoiler, it's not.
Okay.
But also there are caves, and it's a heavily wooded area. Etta's sisters, Alice and Sarah, join the search, and they're also joined by their brother, Donat, who states that he does believe that Etta's dead. Notably, not part of the search is H. When reporters ask if he plans on joining the search for Etta, he says no, but will if they really want him to.
Such a weird response. This guy's just always gonna do the weirdest thing.
Right. Now, eventually the men have to abandon their search. Like, first, like, the weather gets bad, and again, there's no trace of Etta, so they just don't keep going. Now, not long after this, a man named Joseph Gothro arrives in town. Police have been quietly looking for him for months in the hopes that he knows where Etta is. The two, at minimum, are friends, but there's also rumors that the two could be romantically involved. Now, I love that Joseph, in all the other places that I've seen him mentioned or podcasts that cover this, I see a description of him being a prize fighter, as in boxing, but also they leave out that he's a tap dancer. And he's been out of the area because he's been going from town to town. At one point, they had heard that he was dancing at a nightclub in Miami, so they tried finding him there. They looked for him in Mobile, Alabama. Now, when Joseph arrives in town, police bring him in for questioning because, again, they've been looking for this guy for a while. But Joseph didn't even know Etta was missing. He hadn't seen the news reports. He did say that Etta had written to him a few days before her disappearance, But the letter was of a personal nature, and he didn't want to share that with anyone.
Part of me respects that, but then part of me is like, well, maybe for evidence sake.
Right. Like, help out here, my friend. So that's really where the case sits for a bit. They haven't found Etta's body. Joseph ends up having, you know, no information. No one is revealing any more information about Etta. But the thing that doesn't go away is that rumor that she's buried in North Cemetery. The push for her to look for her there, like, that never goes away. And in 1937, so at this point, about 2.5 years after she disappeared, District Attorney Hoban says no. They're not going to dig up the grave. This actually might have backfired on him because bringing it up publicly in the papers, well, the pressure is back on from the public and from her family to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, Hoban changes his mind. And on April 13th, 1937, at 8 a.m., they start digging at Lewis's gravesite. Nearby, H's stepfather, the grave digger, stands by. By 11 a.m., they've confirmed that Etta's body is not in the grave. There are, though, rumblings that they may dig up as many as 3 or 4 other graves in the search, also to look in, you know, to some other additional locations. But Lewis's grave is the only one disturbed in the search for Etta. Oh, Etta's story doesn't really end there. Etta's daughter, Alma, grows up and, as I said earlier, learns of Etta as a teenager. She's told that her father is H and that she can't meet him because he's passed away.
Has he actually passed away?
Well, that's the thing. In 1987, Alma's Aunt Alice sits down with her and shows her a newspaper article about the 50th anniversary of H's marriage to a woman named Evelyn. Mm-hmm. The couple married in 1937. That's the same year they dug up Lewis's grave looking for Etta. Alice tells Alma that H is actually alive and that this man in the article is that man. In learning all of this and about her mother's fight for paternity, we know that at some point, Alma, through legal means, compels H to have a paternity test done. But she still needs to take him to court to get this legally recognized. So in 1990, she files a paternity suit.
Wow. So this went, like, a long time of him, like, really firmly denying it and different women being like, yes.
Yes. Like, no, you.
We are figuring this out. So is he? Did they do it?
So if you're wondering, the statement from her lawyer is that the paternity tests strongly suggest that he's her father. Like, I wonder if it's like one of those Maury moments where it's like, you're 99.9, you know? At this point, Alma has raised her own 5 children. You know, she's made her own place in the world. She wants nothing from H except the legal recognition that he's her father. But her case is actually dismissed in a lower court because the judge states that the paternity statutes only allow for younger children to file charges. Alma's lawyer says that although Alma is 57, Alma only recently found out her father's identity and that there's no statute of limitations made clear in the law. So they're not going to just sit with this dismissal from a lower court. They decide to bring it to a higher court.
I think it's so funny that they're determined to make this man accountable.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Now, Alma says, a lot of people think I want to find my father just for retribution, but that's not the only reason. I want to know who I am.
And that is a very good reason.
Mm-hmm. So despite making clear that she wants no money from him, H continues to fight her. His lawyer said that it was inappropriate for Alma and her lawyer to bring up the paternity tests in the media because they haven't been proven in a court of law, but Alma can't have them proven because the judge dismissed her case.
Jeez.
Right? Now, in July 1995, unfortunately, Alma's claim is rejected. The judges unanimously declare that she has no legal basis to ask the courts to declare that H is her father because there is no, in their minds, substantial reason to do so. Basically, why are you involving us in this?
Right.
In their ruling, they make clear that if there was a substantial reason, say that Alma was trying to have paternity proven so that she could be included in an inheritance, she could pursue that. But Alma always maintained that that's not what she wanted to happen in this case, so she didn't pursue it further.
Right. There's like no legal measurement for somebody wanting to claim their own identity.
Yes.
Right.
So they're like, if you had a reason, like you wanted to be listed as, you know, on his inheritance, like as a beneficiary of his, you know, estate.
Right.
She wasn't.
But just for curiosity's sake.
Yeah. So the court was like, nope, we don't get involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in 1998, H passed away without legally being declared Alma's father. Alma also has since passed away. In her death notice in 2006, her death notice included H's last name. He no longer had a say in what name Alma could claim. Like, what a tribute to her mother that Alma continued her fight. Like, the one that Etta was just, like, hours away from having heard and having her day in court when she disappeared, right? But though this was important to Alma, finding her mother was even more important. This is not something that happened in Alma's lifetime or yet in ours. Alma said she wanted to find her mother so that she could bury her and show the world. And then these are Alma's words. Etta Riel lived and Etta Riel died. And that Etta Riel walked the face of the earth.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, At the Kitchen Table, read by Marsha Mason. Marsha is a four-time Academy Award nominee for her starring roles in The Goodbye Girl, Chapter 2, Only When I Laugh, and Cinderella Liberty. Marsha has received Golden Globe Awards for her film roles and an Emmy Award nomination for Frasier. TV credits include Grace and Frankie, The Middle, The Good Wife, and Madam Secretary. Broadway roles include Impressionism with Jeremy Irons, Steel Magnolias, The Night of the Iguana, King Richard III, and Cactus Flower.
At the Kitchen Table. Etta Riel, 20. Missing since November 22, 1934, from Worcester, Massachusetts. After the train left the station and the harsh November wind swept the last of the leaves from the platform, your daughter waited. Still in her crib, the moonlight pooling around her limbs so deep she felt like she would have to swim to the other side of sleep to find you again. After every star-filled sky you made, that's where you left her. Her cupid's bow mouth and skin still dusty from birth. What if we could return to that minute? Find a woman so hopeful for love, opening the door to a future she believes in, and sit her on a kitchen chair, gather her sisters around her, a coven of protection, their dark heads leaning into one another as their laughter fills the room. What if we could? It would be so beautiful.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.